Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to another episode of If You Love This Planet. We have two different guests on the show today. A little later you will hear from Professor Ravi Shankara, a director with the Earth System Research Laboratory of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Boulder, Colorado. Over the last three decades, he's worked on the chemistry of the Earth's atmosphere as it relates to climate change and ozone depletion. So we'll be hearing from him later in the program. But first, an interview with Daniel Ellsberg, which I conducted as part of a six-part series called The New Nuclear Danger for Pacifica Radio in 2005. Daniel is an author and ex-consultant to the Defense Department and the White House, where he specialized in problems of the command and control of nuclear weapons, nuclear war plans, and crisis decision-making in the late 1950s and early 60s. So from the Pacifica Radio Archives, please enjoy this discussion between myself, Helen Caldicott, and Daniel Ellsberg. I'd now like to introduce Dr. Dan Ellsberg. You've all heard and known about Dan. He helped to bring down the Nixon administration. He released the Pentagon Papers under great secrecy. He's a national treasure, really, for what he's done in the past. And he's still as articulate and as highly intelligent as he ever was. And we're bringing him into this session to discuss the present Bush administration, the past Clinton administration, where he sees this country going. Because from his perspective, having taken on the Nixon administration, I'm fascinated to see what he thinks about what is happening at this point in time. So, Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Helen.
Dan, what I want to ask you now is what your take is on the present administration compared to past administrations and what you know about presidents and what they tend to do.
Well, what's come out made me very worried that if Saddam Hussein did have weapons of mass destruction, so-called chemical or biological weapons, and use them against our troops, I was very worried that the U.S. would reply with the first use of nuclear weapons. And that's not entirely because of the people who are in this administration. It does go back to the earlier Bush senior administration and right through Clinton, namely to an unwillingness of the United States after the ending of the Cold War with the Soviet Union to adopt a position of no first use. There's been a theme in all of these recent administrations that the United States still, for reasons they didn't spell out, still needed to threaten first use of nuclear weapons. And this notion of weapons of mass destruction, which I believe came in the earlier Bush senior administration, was meant, I think, to confound chemical and biological weapons with nuclear weapons, to imply that it would be legitimate and necessary and right to reply to any use of gas, nerve gas, or biological weapons with nuclear weapons. And they didn't want that to be called first use. That had a bad ring to it. So they wanted to imply that it would be second use of weapons of mass destruction. There was this category of weapons of mass destruction in which included both nuclear and chemical and biological. And I think, looking back on it in particular, I think the intent always was to wield a threat of our using nuclear weapons against an opponent that had or used chemical and biological weapons.
So really, from a medical point of view, the only weapon of mass destruction is a nuclear weapon.
Yes, it's a matter of degree that is so great that it really is a difference in quality here, in effect. It's in a class by itself.
By orders of magnitude, it's different.
Very much so. And they have been pounding the idea for some time that biological weapons had the potential for lethality that was comparable to nuclear weapons, but that had to neglect every aspect of distributing it, of actually using it as a weapon in warfare and in a way that would not come back to the state using it.
Well, you just need to look at SARS and see that those sort of bacteria and viruses that they're actually working on at the moment at Los Alamos Labs or about to create genetic engineering for these bacteria come back to haunt anyone with international air travel now. So the notion of biological weapons is crazy, and it's America that's led the world into the production and development of biological weapons, not that Russia didn't have a lot in its own time.
Yes, well, I think these people represent a strain in American strategic thinking that has wanted to make the threat of nuclear weapons by the United States credible. I do think, I continue to think, even after this war, that they were more than willing, really, to see an occasion where the U.S. could actually use a nuclear weapon first as a demonstration to the world that when we say we might use nuclear weapons, we're not just bluffing. I think they wanted to make it credible, and I think they'll still be looking for that, possibly in North Korea.
Let's talk about the fact that Russia and America still have each other targeted with 2,500 hydrogen bombs on hair trigger alert, and America still has a policy not just of first use, but of winnable secret preemptive nuclear war against Russia. Because the Russians know that there's a plan for preemptive nuclear war against them and that America would want to kill their missiles before they leave their silos and the like, it makes the Russians very paranoid, A, because their early warning system now only works 8 hours a day. They're losing their satellites. And B, because they never know when America might attack, not on purpose, but maybe by accident. Who knows? And so I don't know if you know about this, Dan, but in 1995, in January, Norway launched an old American missile, I suppose a Titan, with a weather satellite on top. Now, the Pentagon had warned the Kremlin that they were going to do this, but the Kremlin lost the information. They picked up the telemetry from the missile, and the infrared detector on the satellite picked it up, radioed back to Moscow. That took 15 minutes, and they said, good God, we're under attack. Yeltsin, who is a hardened alcoholic, sat before the football or the computer codes that were open for the first time in 50 years in the Cold War. They'd never opened them before. And he had a three-minute window of opportunity to press his button before the missiles could be lost and killed by American hydrogen bombs. 10 seconds before the end of that interval, Dan, the missile veered off course and they shut the computer. Now, that was a major story in the New York Times, of course, buried in the back pages. And we were 10 seconds from annihilation. And that's what gets me. It's not that they would do it on purpose now because, you know, they're friends, but the system is set up still ready to go by accident or design.
Yes, well, I do know that story. And I would agree with you that the greatest danger that the world faces right now, not the most likely, but the most catastrophic in its consequences, is the possibility for a kind of false alarm. On either side, either the U.S. or the Russians, the capability is there, and a great deal of it is still on hair trigger alert, although not as much as there used to be. Both this administration, but earlier ones too, Clinton and Bush Sr., really refused to totally dismantle or to take these weapons entirely off alert, and yet that would be, as I think you're implying, I would agree with you, the greatest step that could be taken to improve the security of the human species.
And Russia too. I'm very exercised about this actually because it's only Russia and America that can induce nuclear winter and the end of most life on Earth. I mean, North Korea could bomb Seoul or Tokyo, but that's not the end of life on Earth. And this sort of obsesses me, this notion, and also how we remove these weapons, not just from alert, but how we produce abolition between Russia and America. And I know that Russia's ready to get rid of her weapons. She can't afford them. She doesn't like them. But it's this administration and the nuclear weapons labs and the Pentagon who are holding that up. What would be your comment on that, Dan?
At this point, by the way, Helen, I don't know if I would... I would not dismiss the danger posed by some attitudes in Russia as well as in the
US. Oh, yeah,
well,
no, I agree with that. Yep.
Because with the decay and the demobilization of a large part of their armed forces, they do seem to have adopted a policy very like that of NATO or the U.S. in NATO much earlier, bigger bang for the buck from nuclear weapons and an increased doctrinal reliance on the idea of first use of nuclear weapons themselves.
In Russia.
In Russia. Basically, it's inexcusable that either side of these, either individually or together, the U.S. or Russia, should be maintaining this kind of alert with the tremendous dangers that it poses, as you say, for nuclear winter or for the ending of all life on Earth, because neither side really took advantage of the ending of the Cold War to move decisively in the direction of abolishing nuclear weapons or of ending the danger of a massive exchange. I think I know what you're referring, that the Soviets, former Soviets rather, have been more forthcoming in proposing bigger cuts in the stockpile than the U.S. was willing to join them in. But the fact remains that when they saw their nuclear weapons coming right up to the border of Russia, in principle, with the expansion of NATO, that has not only undoubtedly strengthened right-wing forces within Russia, with the threat that's facing them, but it has led them to talk more about first use of nuclear weapons as their defense. I think this was not wise from their point of view, even facing us. It's simply unwise from any point of view to do that. And the U.S., of course, has always led the way in unwisdom, lack of wisdom in this area right from the beginning of the nuclear age.
And then there's the National Missile Defense System, of course, which threatens Russia because it's obviously being set up not for rogue states necessarily at all, but as I worked out when I wrote the book, The New Nuclear Danger, it's actually being set up so that it's part of America's defense system against Russia, particularly if America strikes first and misses a few of the Russian missiles.
Well, why not? Why wouldn't you say against China, for example?
Well, China's only got 18 old liquid-fueled missiles that can hit America. She's virtually not nuclear-armed in terms of attacking the United States at all.
I would like to believe that that would remain the case. I would say that, I'm sorry to say, that it's easy for me to imagine, and not just imagine, there are indications of this, that China will waste their money in making the world more dangerous by actually building up their weapons more than they have, led again by the United States.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm sure we do agree on the point that the United States not only led the way in the arms race at every step of the way, but has been very intransigently committed to threatening the use of nuclear weapons, the first use of nuclear weapons in a variety of situations, and that in that world where the U.S. is clearly not going to fulfill its obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty of working toward an abolition of nuclear weapons, in that world, I think the U.S. is going to be joined in a dangerous posture by a number of other countries.
Well, it's interesting because China has said or implied that if America goes through with its national missile defense or SHIELD, that it will be forced to build more nuclear weapons in order to supersaturate the system. And so Russia's implied that too. So that creates a vertical nuclear arms race between Russia, America and China. And also, I found out that the Pentagon has been writing articles setting China up as the new Cold War enemy and ringing it with bases and threatening it, even though it's one of the biggest trading partners that America has. And that's coming from the military perspective because, you know, with 1.3 billion people and with their sort of road onto capitalism now, the military see them as a threat to America's global dominance. So what you said is actually accurate. And I see that unless we can get the American people to wake up and do something about this crazy government that they've got at the moment, that, you know, we're sort of doomed. I mean, I can't see any other way out of it except to educate and mobilize the American people like we did in the 80s, Dan.
Yes, well, there was, as led by you, actually, Helen, to a very large degree, there was a terrific process of public education. We were up against what looked like an immovable object at that point, the Reagan administration, which was not going to get out of the arms race. Although there, of course, you know, there's a great irony, for whatever reason, Reagan himself did come very close for a matter of, what, minutes or hours to an agreement with Gorbachev to
abolish
nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles.
Wasn't that an extraordinary weekend at Reykjavik?
That's right. He was pulled back from that moment of wisdom, use that term, by very specifically the Prince of Darkness himself, Richard Pearl.
So tell us what the Prince of Darkness actually did to pull Reagan back from abolishing nuclear weapons with Gorbachev.
The stories that came out in books by people like Strobe Talbot and others about that incident, this was a while ago, was that a number of people from the Defense Department were appalled at the notion that Reagan might actually be willing to give up our great trump card, the nuclear weapons, and spent the night fashioning arguments, trying to make conditions that the Russians would be sure to reject, or they would somehow pull their boss back. I think a key aspect of that was focusing him on the notion that he must insist on the anti-ballistic missile.
Yeah, Star Wars.
On Star Wars.
And Gorbachev.
And Gorbachev, in turn, was not ready to swallow that, so that killed that proposal.
Well, let me tell you, I went to Reykjavik, Dan, to that house, and it's an interesting story because the Icelanders took me there. There was a little small sitting room where Reagan and Gorbachev met. The Russians came armed with data and facts and figures and the notion to abolish nuclear weapons. Richard Pearl was sitting upstairs in the bathroom on the lavatory with...
You know a lot more details than I do.
Yeah, with a board across the bath.
Medical details and all the...
Well, no, he wasn't. Like he was sitting on the lavatory because there was nowhere else to sit. With a board across the bath because there was no table, doing the facts and numbers, trying to outdo the Russians because they'd arrived so well... you know, prepared. In the basement were the KGB drinking vodka, and one of them threw a lighted match into the waste paper basket and nearly burnt the whole place down. So it was a dramatic weekend, and I remember George Shultz came out an absolutely shocked individual. What it did for me was to see that two mere mortals over a weekend actually could agree to eliminate nuclear weapons.
Well, that's the state of the world. It's less shocking to imagine that, I suppose, than to realize that these same two individuals, or actually just one of them, would be enough to order the destruction of life on Earth.
Yeah, that's right. And now,
so people,
who's the man...
That degree of imperial power, which has never been seen in the world before, could, in principle, and in that particular case, they came close to doing it in practice, could turn the machine off. But the machine has a lot of inertia there, and as we saw, one mere mortal president of the United States was not able to swing the thing after all. He was brought back to his senses, which is to say, back to
the status quo,
perpetuating this insane...
By the Prince of Darkness. I'm going to use that. Now, Dan, tell us how you feel about having George Bush, or George II, in charge of the button.
I saw some posters during the demonstrations about Mad King George. Certainly he's a king by any practical meaning. Now Congress at this point seems to have delegated its powers just routinely of war and peace over to the president. They're not the first, but they're still doing it. Congress to be doing that, and that makes the president a king essentially. Is he mad? Well, it's very hard to understand whether how much George Bush can actually believe of the misstatements that he keeps saying. Did he really believe that Saddam Hussein was the most dangerous threat to our security and to the world's security in the world? That's a crazy statement, and you have to make some judgment. In the end, I can't really decide whether he really believed such a thing or was simply lying or was simply reading a line. All those are possible. But certainly we've come to a point where delegating the existence of the human species to a man, a single man, like George W. Bush, is particularly frightening. Still, it would be just only marginally less frightening for that power to be held by almost any other man you could name, or woman, for that matter. In other words, it's inherently a very dangerous situation. And the fact that this particular president seems very unwise in many ways and uninformed, ignorant, not very interested in world affairs, it really seems, and acting dogmatically and choosing very, very hawkish advisors, all of that makes it particularly dangerous.
Yeah, do you think he chose them or do you think they chose him?
Well, I don't think. People like Wolfowitz and Pearl were at a lower level but seemed to be very influential. I don't think they were in a position to pick him.
Who picked George?
Vice President is an interesting question. That was a big decision.
It was a big decision, and I think that he needed a daddy at that time. He remember during the election he kept calling him Mr. Secretary all the time, and he leant on him. And I think it was only after September 11th where George Bush got the calling to know why he was president, when he stood on that mound of terrible destruction at the World Trade Center with a bullhorn. And I think the American people were so desperate for a daddy or some authority figure that they transferred that desperation onto this particular individual. And now, well, should I say, I think he's become a megalomaniac in a certain way. I mean, he says, I pray every night and I read the Bible and God's telling me what to do, and that's it, QED.
Yes, I thought it was very telling quote of his to Bob Woodward in Woodward's book directly, where he said, you know, people who advise the president, they have to explain their reasons for recommending this or a warning against that. But as president, I don't feel I have to explain anything to anybody. Mm. That's what being president means to him. That's definitely worrisome and a sign of monarchical tendencies.
No subtleties or innuendos or
He just has to go by his gut. He relies on his gut, and our existence, to a large extent,
depends upon his gut.
Depends on his gut, yeah, right. Now, I don't know how reassuring you find that as a doctor.
Well, I, as we're discussing this, have a pain in my abdomen. As I mean, I have a visceral reaction to this, because it's not just the human species that are at stake, Dan. It's 30 million other species that cohabit the planet with us. So that's...
Over, I think our problem is certainly simply not George W. Bush as an individual.
Right.
It's not only these other people who are peculiarly, I think, addicted to using American power to run the world, addicted to power. And I think they wanted, as we see in Iraq, to control the oil reserves of the Middle East as a major basis for running the world. I happen to think that these people see as also as an essential instrument a credible threat of U.S. nuclear first use. They want to make sure, I think for that to that end, for example, they're quite likely to press the reopening of testing of nuclear weapons. I think that's
part
of their agenda.
Yeah, I do too. And then I come back to the aphorism that says, in a dark time, the eye begins to see. And I look at those millions of people all over the world who demonstrated for weeks against the invasion of Iraq. And they've been activated. And if we can then educate them to a deeper level about what the Bush administration is actually all about in their plans and the like, then there might be some hope. Would you agree with that, Dan?
I think some 16 million people demonstrated, which is unique, of course, in world history. There's never been a coordinating of a movement against a war or against empire like that. And, of course, that is a basis for hope.
Yeah.
At the same time, I found, and I wonder if you didn't find the same thing, I find it very hard to make even people who are very against the war, do not want the war, imagine that we could be so reckless as actually to begin a nuclear war, that is, to launch nuclear weapons. It's very hard to make almost anyone, I think, who hasn't been exposed to war plans, as I have, and who hasn't studied some of our past first-use threats of nuclear weapons, they simply can't believe that that this is a serious problem. And so there, I think you and I and others who are concerned about this face a very serious obstacle in bringing political pressure to bear against that, because people can hardly believe that the threat is there.
Well, it also puts an enormous responsibility upon our shoulders, Dan. I believe. I mean, I feel that terribly deeply.
I agree. And it makes it hard for my wife to live with, to a certain extent, over year after year after year, with my sense of responsibility on this, there's sort of a constant threat of crisis, nuclear crisis,
that's
hanging
right
over our family, and makes it hard. It's hard for people to keep at it, but they're still at it, so you and I have to still be at it.
That's right. And to that end, I've set up a new think tank in Washington. I call it a conservative think tank because I want to conserve life on Earth, called the Nuclear Policy Research Institute. Mm. And the goal is to put people like you and others on the media to debate with the right wing constantly, so that we get equal time with the right wing. And so we educate the American people, and through that create yet again, Dan, a massive grassroots movement as we had in the 80s.
Yeah. I was on a program with a very right-wing commentator named, it's called Hannity and Combs on the
mm-hmm.
And the right-wing side of that pair was actually congratulating me on my work on Vietnam, of all things, that I had been right on Vietnam, but that I was wrong to oppose the war in Iraq. But he did give me some credit, more than I expected from him.
Mm.
But in the course of it, that discussion, he actually did mention, just in passing almost, that we had been right to drop the bomb on Hiroshima. Now, this was somebody, I think, who wasn't born at the time of Hiroshima. And, of course, he's only reflecting an attitude that is held by the majority of Americans. So he's saying that is almost a truism. I didn't have time. Our few minutes was up. That was one of his last comments to take him on that. But I noticed that I'd been preceded on that program. I'd been watching in the green room, and the guest ahead of me was somebody, a military man from the Pentagon, who actually did mention that, of course, the use of nuclear weapons against Saddam's use of gas weapons would be necessary and effective. And again, there was no counter to that. There was no challenge. That was taken almost as self-evident. The occasion was that it had just come out in the L.A. Times, you know, probably Bill Arkin's article, that Rumsfeld had a small group working for him picking nuclear targets in Iraq in such case. And that was a story that came out and was a one-day story, but got very little reaction. The reaction I should have been, I would say, would be congressional hearings, witnesses, people coming up, and the movement picking that up, you know.
Yeah, and
under
a huge...
No conditions much we use nuclear weapons. At the moment, we're starting close to zero on that movement, Helen.
I know, and the press is absolutely... It's lost its legitimacy, and it's not teaching the American people the truth, and thus is leading them towards their own suicide, I'd have to say.
It's hard to end any of discussion like this on a really cheerful, hopeful note at all, and I don't know how to do it. It's, in fact, as you say, it is a dark time, but it is also the case that there is, in the movement against this war, there is a foundation, I think, for movement against nuclear weapons.
And so I would just end on a semi-optimistic note to say, if you want to go to the website of the new conservative think tank that I've started and we'll be using Dan too on the media, is nuclearpolicy.org. And if you want to learn about what Dan and I have been talking about in greater depth, read my new book, which is called The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military Industrial Complex. And it's sort of like the Grey's Anatomy for the planet. I had to learn Grey's Anatomy to become a physician. Now we're all physicians to a planet that's in the intensive care unit with an acute clinical emergency. And so we now all have to minister and doctor to the planet to make sure it survives. And Dan is probably one of the leading doctors in this area. So thank you, Dan.
That was Daniel Ellsberg, an interview conducted as part of a six-part series called The New Nuclear Danger for Pacifica Radio in 2005. Ellsberg is the author of three books, Papers on the War, Secrets, A Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, and Risk, Ambiguity and Decision. In December 2006, he was awarded the 2006 Right Livelihood Award, known as the Alternative Nobel Prize, in Stockholm, Sweden. Dan Ellsberg is the subject of a brand new documentary just released in the US called The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. The film, directed by Judith Ehrlich and Rick Goldsmith, runs on two tracks, as a personal biography of Ellsberg and a historical snapshot of what he did. You can find out about the film at www.mostdangerousman.org. www.mostdangerousman.org. Now, on the If You Love This Planet program, we'll hear from Professor Ravi Shankara. Dr. Ravi Shankara is the director of the Chemical Services Division of the Earth System Research Laboratory of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Boulder, Colorado. Dr. Ravi Shankara has worked over the last three decades on the chemistry of the Earth's atmosphere as it relates to stratospheric ozone depletion, climate change, and regional air quality. His many awards include the Polanyi Medal of the Royal Society of Chemistry,
the Stratospheric Ozone Protection Award of the US Environmental Protection Agency and the American Chemical Society's Award for Creative Advances in Environmental Sciences. He is currently a co-chair of the WMO-UNEP Science Assessment Panel on Stratospheric Ozone at the UN. He served on many national and international committees. Welcome to If You Love This Planet, Dr. Ravi Shankara.
Thank you. Pleasure to be there.
I was very interested in your work on nitrous oxide. I am a physician, a pediatrician. I've used nitrous oxide in medicine, particularly in women delivering babies. I was aware that nitrous oxide is emitted from fertilizers that we use. I was also aware that nitrous oxide is a global warming gas, but I was unaware of its activity in the stratosphere on the ozone layer. And just to preface this discussion, I live in Australia, and in the summer, the ozone hole closes over at the South Pole, but the ozone, as you know, over the south of Australia is very thin, and we have the highest incidence of malignant melanoma in the world and skin cancers. So this is very relevant to us. I would like you to first discuss the role of CFC gases in the destruction of ozone, and because of the Montreal Protocol, what has happened to the release of CFC gases, and then we'll move on to the nitrous oxide sector.
As you know, the chlorofluorocarbons were shown to be detrimental to the ozone layer by the pioneering work of Professors Rowland and Molina, for which they got a Nobel Prize. And the work they did showed that these very stable, inert gases, when released from the Earth's surface for various human activities, would eventually get to the stratosphere where the harsh UV radiation would break them apart, and the chlorine from those chlorofluorocarbons would then catalytically destroy ozone. So a small amount of the CFCs could lead to a large destruction of the ozone layer. And we need to keep in mind that there's a constant kind of a balance between the generation of ozone and its destruction. And the addition of the chlorofluorocarbons led to a faster rate of destruction so that the net balance would shift towards lower amounts of ozone in the stratosphere.
How is the ozone formed in the stratosphere naturally, Dr. Ravi Shankara?
The way it's formed is by simply the molecular oxygen that is everywhere absorbs harsh UV radiation and then falls apart to give two oxygen atoms. And the oxygen atoms immediately react with molecular oxygen to make ozone molecule containing three atoms of oxygen.
So the chlorine stays up there for a long time, doesn't it? For about 100 years, just destroying more and more ozone molecules?
Yes, the chlorine stays, the air in the stratosphere is circulated out of the stratosphere depending on roughly 10 years, let's say. But because the CFCs are not destroyed in the lower part of the atmosphere, they go back in to the stratosphere again, so that their effect on the stratosphere lasts for tens of years to hundreds of years, depending on which of the CFCs we're talking about.
And tell us what CFCs have been used for in the past, and then you talk about CFC banks that can still emit chlorofluorocarbon gases. What has the human race used them for, Dr. Ravi Shankara?
One of the primary uses originally was for refrigeration. They're ideal molecules for the refrigerators, air conditioners, and things of that nature. And then in addition, they have also been used for blowing foam and many of the solvents in some applications.
Plastic foam.
Yes.
Yeah, for furniture, yes.
So over the years, because of their incredibly good properties, they were employed for multiple industrial uses, like mm-hmm. the ones I mentioned. The banks, as you know, the CFCs were regulated by the Montreal Protocol, which has been extremely successful in reducing the amount of chlorofluorocarbons in the atmosphere, at least the emission. And now the atmosphere is going to respond, and it's going to take time to remove the chlorofluorocarbons. The banks are specifically the chlorofluorocarbons and halons that are containing bromine that have been already produced, but they have not yet been released into the atmosphere. They're sequestered, let's say, for example, in old air conditioners, in foam that's already in buildings and things of that nature. So this essentially is already made, and unless somebody actively takes them out and destroys them, they will eventually get back into the atmosphere to continue to destroy the ozone layer.
And how can one destroy CFC gases?
Oh, there are multiple techniques. I'm not really an expert in that area. One of the ways you can destroy it is by incineration and a few other processes. But yeah. The key thing is to be able to capture them so that you can do something with them.
And I believe CFC is a potent global warmer as it rises up to destroy the ozone layer 10,000 to 20,000 times more potent than CO2?
Yes. So in addition to their action on the stratospheric ozone, chlorofluorocarbons are also very potent greenhouse gases because they absorb the infrared radiation in precisely the region if they were not absorbed, they would be escaping to space. These are called atmospheric windows. And because of their ability to absorb infrared radiation extremely efficiently, and because they live for a significant amount of time, they are very potent greenhouse gases. And as some of the people in our colleagues here have shown, the Montreal Protocol did an awful lot towards helping the climate because of the reduction of the emissions of chlorofluorocarbons. Mm.
Would you like to comment then on the properties of global warming and ozone depletion of HCFC gases, which were the replacement made for CFC gases?
Certainly. HCFCs also contain chlorine, just like CFCs. However, they are much more ozone-friendly because they don't live in the atmosphere as long. So a smaller fraction of the molecules will get to the stratosphere. In addition, because they live in the atmosphere for a shorter time, even though they also absorb infrared radiation that Earth gives off, they don't tend to accumulate into higher concentrations. So they're also less effective in terms of the global warming potential.
What is their lifespan?
Depending on which HCFC you're talking about, it could be a few years to tens of years, as opposed to CFCs that live for tens of years to centuries.
Mm. Well, I'm very interested now in your work on nitrous oxides. First of all, where are they emanating from on the Earth? What does the human race use to produce nitrous oxides, number one? And number two, what are their effects upon the atmosphere, both the troposphere, the lower level, and the upper level, the stratosphere?
Nitrous oxide, unlike the chlorofluorocarbons, has both a natural source and a human-influenced source. So nitrous oxide actually has been around with us for thousands of years, but it is pretty constant. over those times. Since industrialization, the nitrous oxide has been increasing, and it has increased by about to now roughly 325 parts per billion. It was 270 before industrialization. The sources of nitrous oxide are many. One is agriculture, which is roughly half of the human-produced nitrous oxide because of use of fertilizers. When fertilizers are put into the soil, they react with some of the microbes, do their stuff on this nitrogen oxide, and end up giving nitrous oxide. There's also nitrous oxide produced from effluents to estuaries, etc. And there's also nitrous oxide that's a byproduct of the manufacture of certain chemicals such as nitric acid and adipic acid and things of that nature. So overall, that's the contribution of the nitrous oxide. So what we did was to ask the question, what does nitrous oxide look like if you viewed it as an ozone-depleting gas? But we're talking only about the part of the nitrous oxide that's produced by human activities.
Anthropogenic.
Yes, the anthropogenic nitrous oxide. So we did some calculations using chemistry that's been well known, the pioneering work of Professor Paul Crutzen and Harold Johnston. Paul Crutzen now is in Mainz in Germany. He also got a Nobel Prize in chemistry for his work on the stratospheric ozone layer. And Professor Harold Johnston retired from the University of California in Berkeley. They had shown that nitrogen oxides can destroy ozone. And if you remember, the whole issue of humans affecting the ozone layer was because of the supersonic transport and the nitrogen oxide emitted by those supersonic planes.
Could you remind us about that, please? When that happened, the supersonic aeroplanes flying in the stratosphere, who made the aeroplanes and what did they do and when did they do it?
Certainly. In the 60s, there were plans being made for having a very large fleet of supersonic transport planes to fly across the Pacific and the Atlantic. And then the people started asking the question, what would be the environmental effect of supersonic transport? And that's when Paul Crutzen and Harold Johnston pointed out that the nitrogen oxides from the engines that would be running at high temperatures would, when they're flying in the stratosphere, because the supersonic transport would be flying much higher in the atmosphere, and that they would lead to the destruction of the ozone layer. And then there are lots of studies that were carried out. The supersonic transport never became a very significant reality. The American manufacturers, specifically Boeing, never commercially built supersonic transport for mass transportation. On the other hand, the Concordes were built in Europe, but they turned out to be very small in number. From what I understand, the decision not to have supersonic transport planes was more economic rather than for environmental reasons. But in whatever the case may be, the point is it was the original harbinger of this issue, and people thought about it, and the chemistry responsible for the ozone layer destruction was actually worked out during that period. So what we did was use essentially that chemistry for understanding nitrous oxide.
And how does the chemistry work then, Dr. Ravi Shankara, of nitrous oxide and ozone depletion?
Yes. Just like the chlorofluorocarbons, nitrous oxide is very stable in the lower part of the atmosphere, in the troposphere. So a nitrous oxide emitted into the atmosphere then gets transported into the stratosphere, where again chemical reactions and light destroy nitrous oxide. And in the process, a small amount, roughly 10% of the nitrous oxide, is converted into nitric oxide, precisely the same thing that would have come out of a supersonic transport plane. And then they catalytically destroy ozone just the same way as chlorine dust from CFCs or the nitric oxide from the aircraft would have done. And then we calculated roughly what is the effect of nitrous oxide. If you quantify it using a quantity that's called ozone depletion potential, we calculated that the nitrous oxide destroys ozone with an efficiency of roughly 1/60th. It's actually much less than the chlorofluorocarbon 11. However, because the emission of nitrous oxide by anthropogenic activity is so large, it's much, much larger than the emissions of CFCs, that the effect of nitrous oxide becomes significant for the ozone layer depletion.
So why is the contribution of nitrous oxide so large?
Because the total emission of nitrous oxide is much, by anthropogenic activity, is much larger than that of chlorofluorocarbon.
So it's from agriculture, from estuaries with organic material in them. What else?
And chemical manufacture byproduct. Also in terms of in sewage treatment plants and things of that nature.
Yeah, and we use a bit in medicine.
Yes, it turns out the amount of nitrous oxide used for anesthetics is a very, very small fraction of these sources. We calculated that before. It's actually pretty negligible.
So you're saying that because there's such an amount of nitrous oxide produced, that it produces, in effect, the same amount of damage quantitatively as CFCs would do if they were still being produced?
Yes. I need to clarify that very carefully. Nitrous oxide is not currently destroying as much ozone as chlorofluorocarbons altogether.
Mm.
However, if they continue to increase, then they would. Okay? And there's a good news, bad news story. One of the reasons nitrous oxide is not destroying as much as chlorofluorocarbons is because quite a bit of chlorofluorocarbons has already accumulated in the atmosphere. And the good news is because the ozone layer, because of the Montreal Protocol, the chlorofluorocarbons are decreasing. The emissions are decreasing to the point that the emissions of nitrous oxide now is the dominant emission of ozone depleting substances. So even though currently it's not depleting as much ozone as chlorofluorocarbons, the effect of chlorofluorocarbons is going to keep going down, and the effect of nitrous oxide is going to keep going up, so that in the future it will be the dominant destroyer of the ozone layer also. Not only the emission, but even in terms of what's happening in the future date.
So what's its lifespan in the stratosphere, nitrous oxide, as compared to CFC?
The overall atmospheric lifetime of nitrous oxide is about 100 years. In fact, its lifetime is almost the same as CFC-12, that is CF2-Cl2 molecule. And its lifetime in the stratosphere, it is destroyed quite rapidly in the stratosphere.
Okay. How are we going to decrease the emissions of nitrous oxide anthropogenically, Dr. Ravi Shankara?
This is where I beg your indulgence. I'll just point out that I do the science. and as to how people are going to take care of it. That they have to consider so many different factors in making their decision. And I respect that that's what they have to do. And the only thing I would request is that in making the decision, they include the scientific findings from studies such as ours in making the decision.
So how well known are your studies, Dr. Ravi Shankara, in the ozone depletion world and in the Montreal Protocol world?
That's a good question. All I can tell you is it was published in a very widely read scientific magazine, The Science. It's probably one of the most premier science magazines. Secondly, it will be assessed along with other things in the next round of the scientific assessment of the ozone layer. And third, the people in the Montreal Protocol, they are pretty savvy about what's going on, and they will be aware of it if they're not already aware of it.
Yeah.
In fact, they're meeting in Egypt this week.
Oh, that's good. So tell us about the global warming potential of nitrous oxide compared to CFC.
Okay, global warming potential of nitrous oxide are comparable within a factor of 2 or 3, that of CFC. So it has been known for quite a while that nitrous oxide is a very significant global warming gas. And so that is the point, one of the points we made in our paper, is that if nitrous oxide emission were reduced, it would help not only the ozone layer, it would also help the climate.
So you say they're 2 to 3 times less significant than CFC in global warming. Is that correct?
No. It's in terms of the global warming potential.
Yeah.
The total contribution of current contribution of nitrous oxide to that of CFC is roughly comparable.
Comparable.
I have to look up the numbers.
Again,
it's because of how much is emitted and how much is retained in the atmosphere.
Now, the last thing I want to ask you, Dr. Ravi Shankara, is the contribution of methyl bromide, which is used on crops and in agriculture and in destroying insects. And I don't think the production or use of that has declined. And I think it does destroy the ozone layer and possibly is a global warming agent. Is that true or not?
Methyl bromide does destroy the ozone layer. Does contribute to that. It is not a very significant global warming gas. It is being produced. However, its concentration has started to decrease in the atmosphere because its emissions are being regulated by the Montreal Protocol.
Oh.
But it's not completely removed. It's still being emitted into the atmosphere.
Is it as potent as CFC in ozone reduction?
On a molecule-by-molecule basis, it's much, much more potent.
Goodness me. There's another gas, nitrous something or other, that's now being produced to make...
Nitrogen trifluoride?
Yeah, nitrogen trifluoride to make flat-screen TVs. And I hear that people like you and Crutzen, et cetera, are getting worried about that. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, nitrogen trifluoride is another gas which is reasonably inert, and it's also a potent gas, potent greenhouse gas. So, it's something to keep our eyes on. If its concentration in the atmosphere gets to be large, then it would be another greenhouse gas one has to consider.
And does it cause ozone depletion?
We do not believe so. Because the fluorine in chlorofluorocarbons also do not lead to a significant ozone depletion. The chemistry is kind of very interesting. But I'm sure we don't want to go into a large chemistry lecture
right now. I would like it as a scientist, but I think...
Yeah, it turns out that nitrogen trifluoride would not be a significant ozone depleting gas. It's a significant global warming gas, potentially, if it continues to increase.
Now, one last question I have for you, Dr. Ravi Shankara, is... CFC-114 gas is still used at the uranium enrichment plant at Paducah, Kentucky. Hundreds of miles of pipes containing this gas are used to cool the uranium hexafluoride gas, which is thermally very hot. And there are tremendous leaks from these very old pipes. And the nuclear industry has been grandfathered out of the Montreal Protocol. And according to the EPA, 93% of the CFC-114 gas released in America comes from the uranium enrichment plant. Would you like to comment on that, please? According to the EPA, that CFC-114 is 10,000 to 20,000 times more potent than CO2 as a global warmer.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
Just like the other CFCs.
Yeah.
But the concentrations in the atmosphere of that compound, from what I know, is not very large because I don't remember seeing them very often. I can actually look that up.
So what is the most common CFC gas in the atmosphere?
It's the CFC-11.
CFC-11,
On 11 and 12 are the...
11 and
114 12. Has a lifetime of approximately 300 years.
Yep.
It is a significant global warming potential and a significant 114 is about 10,000 times CO2 in terms of the global warming potential.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. You've answered all my questions, and I'm very grateful to you, Professor Ravi Shankara, for at this very late notice to be interviewed by us for If You Love This Planet. It's been very enlightening.
You're most welcome.
My guest today was Dr. Ravi Shankara, the Director of the Chemical Services Division of the Earth System Research Laboratory of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Boulder, Colorado. I'm sure you'll agree that that was an absolutely fascinating interview, particularly in the light of global warming and ozone depletion. And these are subjects, although a little tricky in chemical terms, are very important for us to all know about and to understand in some depth. Thank you very much for listening today to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and we'll be talking with you next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.